Laws of Media, which came out in 87. No, 88. The Letters came out in 87. And he said, holy crap, this is what I do. Now, what he did, he invented what I call tetrad management. He saw that presidents, prime ministers, and government committees and intelligence agencies have to look at a whole complex of a complicated ecology. And so he developed what was called sociological algorithms, which was like looking at the effects of politics and events and media that causes them. So he came up with something like the tetrad. And these sociological algorithms is what Gorbachev wanted from George Bush when they met in Malta in December 89. The wall had gone down a month before. Now the old Cold War enemies are trying to figure out what to do with themselves, you know, what's going to happen, and what's her role now, post-Cold War. And Gorbachev knew all the Soviet satellite countries, Latvia and the rest of them, Estonia, would all collapse. No, the Soviet control of them would collapse, and they'd start wanting their own nationalism. So he thought that sociological algorithms would give them cues so the KGB could anticipate the new fads and moods and political disruption that was coming. So what was amazing is that the tetrad was a key negotiating point in after the Cold War ended in December 89. And it was based on this Baltimore scientist had discovered the tetrad accidentally. He figured out looking at multi-level effects. And so when he saw the book, the Evergreens told me, he said, wow, this is better than this. McLuhan did it better than me. So then he kind of adapted McLuhan. So that's the most advanced political use of what the CIA were developing and learning instinctively, and McLuhan was tracking them. So here's McLuhan influencing Hollywood, intelligence agencies, scholarship, all over the place he's influencing. You know, that's Shelley's idea 200 years ago, that the poets are the true legislators, the unacknowledged legislators of the world. So Finnegan's Wake was the unacknowledged new science, which McLuhan exploited.
And everybody had to ignore him.
And I pick up the book, and there it is. She says, as we shall see, is on page 85, as we shall see in part 3, McLuhan himself challenged the idea of scientific law or statement in his posthumous volume, Laws of Media, subtitled The New Science, a volume which contains several references to Capra's ideas. The subtitle refers to Vico's idea of new science, a philosophical interpretation which undermined the modern idea of science in Descartes and Newton. Vico was the McLuhan of Descartes, Newton's day. And then McLuhan built on. See, Francis Bacon came up with the new science. Then Vico picked up that thread and made a book, The New Science. And then McLuhan came up with the new science. Bacon to Vico to McLuhan via Finnegan's Wake. And, you know, Vico is an important framework in Finnegan's Wake.
Okay, Doug. And next. What the new physics and Eastern philosophies have in common is...
Well, wait a minute. Let's look at... Okay, this is an interesting part. She's going to say... She's going to try to explain how McLuhan came up with a new science and he's challenging traditional science. So, I think you read this part, but I'll do it anyways again. In his preface to the volume, Eric McLuhan... See, he had to finish the book. McLuhan had died and didn't get to finish it. So Eric...
Came out, what, 8 years after he died?
Yes, he died the last day of 1980, and it came out in
1988.
It's actually dated August 8th. It's J.W.'s birthday is when the tetrad was revealed. In his preface to the volume, Eric McLuhan recalls that working on a new edition of Understanding Media, his father started by reviewing its most severe criticisms. He found that some of the most recurring criticisms, quote, seem to form a chorus of, that's all very well for you, Mr. McLuhan, but it's not scientific. So I explained that. You can look at regular science as dealing with kinetics and movement, extension of the muscles. Hence, Laws of Media, says Lamberti, stands as a paradoxical challenge to that accusation. For Capra, as well as for McLuhan, the interval between various levels of approximation is what triggers curiosity and encourages further testing and research. So yes, the tactile interval is what engages your attention, just like someone stuttering, but Capra doesn't know that the tactility of your sensory makeup of your body is now a global environment. It's been extended. The process of discovery is therefore conceived as a continuous dialogue which also gives meaning to errors and indeterminacies. Old models are part of or contained in new ones, and knowledge is a continuous network of possibilities. That's the tactile, interactive, going back and forth of dialogue, which was already happening in the sciences, but they hadn't conceptualized it into the tetrad, which showed in the process of dialogue you're going to have retrievals and flip points and obsolescences. Mm-hmm. And then to show that the environment is doing that right in front of us, and known as the Android meme.
Mm-hmm.
See, so her book is really good for me explaining the true stuff, or the more accurate stuff, or the deeper stuff, or the more relevant stuff.
Yeah, the next level.
Yeah.
The next several paragraphs are about Heisenberg.
Okay, this is good because it's going into the science. Like, how does McLuhan bypass old-fashioned science? Mm-hmm. So Werner Heisenberg, in his volume Physics and Philosophy, gives a fascinating account of this process of discovery when he discusses the historical development of the quantum theory. The volume, the book, is in fact a beautiful journey into the change of approach to knowledge that the new physicists took at the turn of the previous century, you know, that's in the 1920s, when their experiments somehow dismissed most of what was traditionally accepted by classical physics. The description of Planck revealing his conceptual shift, well, that would be earlier than the 20s, revealing his conceptual shift to his son while taking a long walk in the Grunewald wood outside of Berlin constitutes a powerful image conveying the acceptance of conceptual limits and the entering of a new cognitive wilderness, which in fact turns those limits into positive stimuli. Heisenberg recalls how these scientists, himself, Planck, Einstein, Rutherford, Bohr, and others, accepted contradictions and paradoxes as part of their process of discovering theories, which nevertheless were substantially true. In other words, they had to accept the acoustic, multi-level, contradictory effects of jazz, Louis Armstrong, through radio, and they were trying to visualize it. And politics was trying to take the jazz that had integrated the world and created a global Esperanto and reintegrate the blacks into the subculture of books. And so science was doing the same thing the politicians were doing.
Yeah, because the physicists talked all the time about, and I think you mentioned it earlier, they just imagined that they could see these things if they had the right instruments. So they were just making it up based on the possibilities.
Yeah, and then they get a big eureka if an instrument actually saw something that they had speculated.
Yeah.
And then they try to fit it into their visually biased models.
Yeah.
Let's see. You know the quark. It has six characteristics. They would get into the subatomic particle had spin, charm, and strangeness.
Mm-hmm.
I think it had strong force, weak force, but they were getting multi-level, the effects of Cambridge in the New Criticism, multi-semantic meanings for words. They were applying it to their models in physics. They were forced to have multiple aspects or spin, Baroque spirals happening. The complexity was getting more complex for visually biased Gutenberg man.
Mm-hmm.
And then the ultimate complexity is finding its wake.
All right, here's the six. Up quark, charm quark, top quark, down quark, strange quark, bottom quark.
Wow, so they don't have the strong force, weak force in that, 6 points.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so it's like top-down, top-down analysis, bottom-up analysis.
Mm-hmm.
Let's apply a media to that. You've got the Illuminati bankers, that's top, what's she call it? Top something.
Top quark.
Top quark. Then there's a bottom quark?
Yep.
Yeah, that's Elvis. Okay, that's the new technology creating a new music. All right, and then
up quark and down quark.
Okay, top down. Up would be advertising and ratings. What's rising? What do you invest in? That's Wall Street. And what's down? That's what you short. What do they call it? Short play, short
sell short.
Yeah, they sell short. So that's talking about the electrified virtual economy. And then strangeness and
charm
is about your ratings.
Mm.
You know, how you're doing in your charisma factor. So there's a electric showbiz global theater underlying those six characteristics of a subatomic particle. Each one of us is a subatomic particle plus, as McLuhan would add, a super civilized situation. We're both subatomic and super civilized being sent all over the planet via our electric media.
Mm-hmm. Now,
In the particle accelerator, that's what the top of my chart is, a particle accelerator I'm showing of the quadrants.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that seems to be their names.
You can't refute me.
Okay, that was just on the internet. I found those names. So.
And those guys are trying to fit their concepts, six parts, back to visually created models of nature, like the atom and the parts. And they're looking at some part of nature that was created by the phonetic alphabet, a framework, the phonetic alphabet, and then they fit the atoms into it, which was something that was created by the phonetic alphabet way back there by Thales or somebody. Mm-hmm. Forget the guy who did the atom. Maybe there's a couple of them. Who was it? Somebody... Thales, T-H-A-L-E-S, or was that where they were? Anyways, Parmenides, somebody like that. Okay, so now they're trying to continue the particle metaphor. In biology, they call it cells and molecules, mm-hmm. and in physics, and they're trying to take these little things, and because our media environment since the 60s has been so different, you come up with epigenetics. And all the spin-offs of alternative medicine or alternative science that, what's the name of the guy who did epigenetics? Bill somebody or something?
I'm forgetting.
Anyways, you have these fads and New Age workshops where people feel there's something newer going on in matter and the establishment can't adapt to it that way. Mm-hmm. But the real science is noticing the ground, the technological, environmental ground we create mm-hmm. that affects our concepts in different fields. That's the new knowledge.
Okay, clean up. Thales of Miletus is the guy supposedly who discovered atomic theory, T-H-A-L-E-S, and it's Bruce Lipton who, I don't know that he discovered epigenetics, but he's the big proponent of it.
Yeah, there's a whole bunch of them. It started off with Rudolf Sheldrake's morphogenetic field in the early 80s.
Right.
And then Terence McKenna came along and threw in psychedelics into the mix. Mm. And then he discovered McLuhan and backed off a bit about what he was trying to say. And then he tried to bravely catch up to me, but I moved forward with the D-cell and Mir and Dr. Dean, our Pygmalion, that we're raising to meet the needs of the post-Android meme environment. And now we have you people listening to this, maybe even Lamberti, you're listening to the two greatest scientists, artists, politicians, engineers, and Trump simulators available today.
And
later we'll go over and look at the nice remarks that this is evoking.
No,
we've
right.
got to hear Leon going, yay, or something. Where's Leon?
Where's Leon?
Yeah.
So look at this sentence in the middle of that paragraph. Heisenberg admits that the strangest experience of those years was that the paradoxes of quantum theory did not disappear during this process of clarification. On the contrary, they became even more marked and more exciting. So they were evoking them.
Well, they were confronting the complexity that they couldn't solve it, which was exactly the process of how Joyce was writing Fitting's Wake. It was so complex and got out of control almost. He went to Gypsy and mediums to try to get support from the other side. Mm-hmm. He was quite nervous about what he was doing, but he was exploring the complexity of media environments on words and syntax like these guys were in their context. And it was like they couldn't get a finish line.
Yeah. And
so by this time, many physicists, he says, were convinced that these apparent contradictions belong to the intrinsic structure of atomic physics. Well, to the intrinsic structure of visual space mm-hmm. in its attempt to encompass other sensory modalities.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty hard to do.
So
here Lamberti is being a little McLuhan-esque by scanning other developments in other fields, trying to make an interdisciplinary mosaic to imitate what McLuhan did.
Mm-hmm. Okay. The next big topic is ideograms. Do you want to jump to that?
Yeah, is that nearby?
Page 88.
Okay, that's pound.
Yeah. Gets into pound. And then we'll probably finish on this after this section.
Well, the ideogram is a multi-leveled thing. You know, it's an icon. It's more appropriate to the movie era than the phonetic alphabet.
Mm-hmm.
So Pound, Ezra Pound, is groping around in cultures to find a way to write poetry about the new complexity of the urban landscape.
Uh-huh.
And the physicists are dealing with it. They're all dealing with this, the astounding unforeseen effects of the extension of tactility. That's what they're all wrestling with in all the fields. So he finds over in China a guy named Fenollosa that writes an essay on the value of the ideogram and you'd have to get into the particular linguistic factors of it. But Pound's inspired by it. He promotes Fenollosa, and then he tries to make a poetry that's like a Chinese ideogram.
I see.
So if you find a bunch of quotes.
Yeah, there's an indented quote on 88. For the ideograph, even more than the hieroglyph, is a complex gestalt involving all the senses at once. The ideogram affords none of the separation and specialization of sense, none of the breaking apart of sight and sound and meaning, which is the key to the phonetic alphabet.
That's a quote from probably Laws of Media. Or
I'll look it up.
Through footnote 19.
19, McLuhan, the Gutenberg Galaxy.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
But he would repeat that in Through the Vantage Point and Laws of Media. But the point is that Pound realized the phonetic alphabet, like all the vortices, is not adequate. It's too univocal. It's not adequate to contain the multi-level, multi-spatial world that's happening around them.
Yeah.
And it doesn't cause the schizophrenic fragmentation that the phonetic alphabet does.
Right. So Lamberti says, following Pound's experiments with language, McLuhan interpreted the ideogram as a complex form which preserves a harmony and a deep connection between signifier and meaning unknown to the phonetic alphabet, and which involves all the senses simultaneously. Now, McLuhan didn't do ideograms. He appreciated Pound's ideograms, but...
No, the tetrad is an ideogram.
Oh.
And that's the way it's laid out. The four parts are not in a sequential order.
Okay.
He's got enhanced and then observed down the right, obsolescence on the bottom right, then the bottom left is retrieval, and the top opposite the enhancement is the flip, the retrieval. So, yes, there is a subplot of it being the ideogram, but it's not limited to ideogramic issues.
Right. Does she say that? Do you remember when you read the book?
No, I don't know. She might. She might say that. If you look at this paragraph, read it for a while.
The ideogram is therefore associated with the idea of acoustic or tactile space.
Well, look at this sentence, the second sentence. Even though the ideogram appears visually as a sign italicized, mm-hmm. the ideograph still preserves a mode of perception which is multisensorial, referring to a series of images in nature, combinations, situations, and actions which force the reader into active sensory and cognitive participation. So that's preliterate writing. And it is multi-level, like preliterate sensibilities. Then the electric age brings back a new requirement of multi-sensory, multi-spatial complexity. So McLuhan updates the ideogram with the tetrad.
Mm-hmm.
He extends the ideogram into the tetrad. So the passage from orality to literacy in Eastern societies did not contribute to a sensorial change, since it relied upon a non-phonetic form of writing, the ideogram, which preserves and renders an acoustic environment with its multisensorial dynamics. Then she has a quote from McLuhan, non-phonetic writing does not isolate the senses. Tactility is not a sense, but the interplay of all senses.
Mm-hmm.
End of quote. The ideogram, she says, is therefore associated with the idea of acoustic or tactile space, an idea which will be further commented upon later in this chapter, but is here associated with the idea of mimesis. This concept is key to understanding why in McLuhan's writing, the acoustic dimension is conceived as tactile or interactive, to the point of the two terms, acoustic and tactile, being often used synonymously, a fact which detractors use as evidence of McLuhan's lack of precision and of a superficial treatment of things. See, McLuhan was very precise halfway through the book, and the other half of the book had to include non-visual imprecision. He had to do both.
Mm-hmm.
But he was doing both. He was precise and and complementary with the non-precise suggestive parts.
Mm-hmm.
Then she says, such an idea of tactility, of McLuhan's idea, is enhanced by Eastern literacy. Whereas the phoneme represents the extreme atomization of sound and therefore the extreme fragmentation of space and knowledge in micro units detached from a meaningful context, that's the phonetic alphabet she's calling phonemes, the ideogram is a complex and intricate unit, sort of like the morphemes, which preserves a harmony between perception and conceptualization. Whereas the phonetic alphabet isolates a figure from the ground, the ideograph preserves the two in a syncretic way. So McLuhan would say that once we started to have a little writing, plus the pre-writing acoustic tactile culture, it was a balanced situation. Mm-hmm. Like Greece was balanced, the Middle Ages were balanced, but the printing press made us go too extreme into the visual and the conceptual and put us out of balance. Mm-hmm. And then that created the patriarchy and imperialism, capitalism, pollution, and everything that white man now is going to be jailed for doing.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, I guess when I was reading this section and also reading about Pound further on in the book and his ideogram, I hadn't realized how
McLuhan used it.
Yeah, but there. It
maybe she never says it.
Yeah, because Laws of Media, the Tetra, came decades later. What was he doing with Pound before then? What was he using Pound for?
He made some big discoveries from Pound when he went and met Pound in June 1948 at the Insane Asylum down in Washington, D.C., where Pound was imprisoned for treason,
right,
for working for the enemy, Mussolini, during World War II, and doing radio broadcasts. So, Pound.
St. Elizabeth's, was it?
Yeah, St. Elizabeth's is, I don't know what word comes after that, hospital or something.
Right.
But the big breakthrough, as a result of that 2-hour meeting, him and Hugh Kenner, McLuhan got a whole bunch of new ideas, which crystallized his understanding of Edgar Allan Poe and stuff that he started writing in the early 50s that was different from what he wrote in the early 40s. And one key idea was that Pound said, look at my cantos as a detective story. And the whole idea of the crime investigator was a new image for McLuhan. So he went back and reread Poe with this insight and why Poe, developed detective fiction. He invented it.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, he develops symbolist poetry and the whole idea of the effect preceding the cause. So the effect preceding cause idea he got from Pound. And that really was clinching what he had learned from Wyndham Lewis a few years earlier, what he was learning from James Joyce and W.B. Yeats and T.S. Eliot. Mm-hmm. He was a big fan and studier of Eliot in the mid-40s after meeting Lewis. But then when he met Pound, he kind of dropped Eliot and corresponded with Pound for a few years.
Mm-hmm.
So there are some key points in the world of aesthetics and Gutenberg arts as they are transformed into Marconi electric arts. Pound helped him there.
Mm-hmm.
And then McLuhan discovered Innes, and that was a broader view, technological and media environments, and that's when McLuhan synthesized all these different influences from the Cambridge teachers to Siegfried Gideon to Lewis to Pound to Innes, and then McLuhan takes off in 1952 as Innes dies.
So it's St. Elizabeth's with no whatever. It's not an H. What is
of no apostrophe?
No apostrophe. Yes.
It's a plural.
Yeah.
That's Elizabeth probably wrong.
Hospital. Yeah. Well, that's what
St. Elizabeth's Hospital.
Yeah. That's what they call it. And it says it has a checkered history. Okay, so let's wrap it up.
What time is it?
5:24.
Okay, so you have to go out.
Not for half hour, but still, I want to hear what people say, if anything, about what we've been talking about.
All right. So what were we just saying? We're talking about you never got the ideogram. You were wondering what McLuhan was doing before. Yeah, before the tetrad.
Yeah.
So I told you what he got from Pound. Well, he was inventing what's called the mosaic approach. Mm-hmm. So the ideogram is kind of like a mosaic of parts,
mm-hmm.
okay, and it forms a pattern. And it relates to things that you see in nature and in technologies mm-hmm. in the Chinese culture, whereas the phonetic alphabet is these meaningless signs, these letters, 26 letters that have meaningless sounds and imagery. They don't look like trees and chairs, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So they're an extra level of abstraction, which creates the schizoid abstraction of Western man. The ideogram, it has a little bit more percept, and it's just showing you, like, I think you take the ideogram for red, it'll have pictures of rusty objects or red objects in the ideogram.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a mosaic. So McLuhan, he developed a mosaic form of writing. So each page was like Finnegan's Wake. He had different topics at different parts of the page. And for most people, it looked like he was chaotic and jumping from one thing to another and not sticking to a linear argument.
Mm-hmm.
But he was creating a ideogramic mosaic on each page.
Mm-hmm.
And then that became the new science of the tetrad.
Right.
Later.
So a sentence that Lamberti has after that indented quote, in the paragraph following Pound's experiments with language, she has a sentence, the ideogram is therefore associated with the idea of acoustic or tactile space, an idea which will be further commented upon later in this chapter, but is here associated with the idea of mimesis.
Yeah, miming. McLuhan used to say Aristotle was right that we learn by miming. The child imitates whatever the parents
so
are saying.
So she's saying he's imitating Pound in some way, do you think?
No.
Or he just keeps repeating things which are repetition.
He keeps repeating?
McLuhan, in his work using the ideogram, ideogram is associated with the idea of acoustic or tactile space, idea associated with the idea of mimesis.
Right. So Lamberti is saying the book creates linear logic, visual space.
Mm-hmm.
And then the electric media create a new retrieved space, tactility and acoustics, which are more a mosaic. And when you're miming something, you're not looking at a painting with a detached eye and learning how to make perspective.
Mm-hmm.
You're like rap singers or just dancing. You're miming. You see somebody make some movements, you imitate the movements.
Mm-hmm.
So it involves the other senses, not just the eye in a detached position.
Mm-hmm.
So mimesis is more of a multi-sensory form of knowing. And so McLuhan says the electric age brings in a lot of retrieval of mimetic forms of knowing.
Uh-huh.
And you have different ideas in education adapting to correcting the 19th century in educational ideas.
Uh-huh.
So mimesis is a term that McLuhan uses. It's almost like the term from Thomas Aquinas, sensus communis. It means sensory involvement, sensory participation, less detachment that the book exaggerated the I into doing.
Right, and the sentence before the next indented quote, which that quote starts with the letters. So the sentence is, whereas the phonetic alphabet isolates the figure from the ground, the ideogram preserves the two in a syncretic way.
A combined way.
Following the adoption of the phonetic alphabet in the Western world, quote, the letters come to be regarded as not only having no meaning, but also as having no properties. The alphabet served as the formal cause of the dialectic, bracket logic and philosophy, and a visual bracket geometrical space. So she's wrapping it up. But then see how she talks about schizophrenia next.
Yeah, that's the split.
Yeah.
The alphabet served as a formal cause of the dialectic, so people start to have a split in their minds.
Yeah.
And they called it logic and philosophy. And also the Euclidean geometry was impaled on a plane outside of you.
Mm-hmm.
In the mediumist massage, McLuhan has 18th century scientists projecting out of their eyeball a Euclidean pattern on the ground. So Euclidean geometry comes in with the phonetic alphabet, with the beginning of understanding dynamics of visual space. And that leads to a schizophrenia, the split between heart and mind, that the Aboriginal cultures say Western man is evil. He has no understanding of tactile nature and doesn't care about it, and doesn't care about the big turtle or the spirits of the dead that are that they can see. We, visual man, creates a veil between life and death. And it becomes rather crude from the super sensitive aesthetes of pre-literate and tactile cultures, which are way more subtle than literate mechanical man. And so that disservice of visual space caused by the printing press is what McLuhan calls schizophrenia, or he upgrades Freud's term for schizophrenia. He makes it more environmental, not some psychological magnesium deficiency.
And then a sentence in the next paragraph after the schizophrenia quote, literacy is a form of expression which separates percept, that is the mimetic and immediate perception, and concept.
Separates percept and concept.
Yeah. That is the cognitive process of reasoning which enables us to objectify our experience. So you're always talking about the percept concept.
Yeah, so percept is the mimetic and immediate perception. Concept is the cognitive process of reasoning, which enables us to objectify our experience, you know, separate it by detaching from what we perceive and observe as the visual effect.
A nice wrap-up is the very end before the next section where we'll stop.
Well, let me finish the next sentence, finish this paragraph.
Okay.
In sensorial and cognitive terms, the process, so you're not looking at it as a concept. You're just looking at the sensory mechanisms. In sensorial and cognitive terms, the process results in a separation between inner and outer worlds. That's what the phonetic alphabet does. Between the inner self and the broader set of external situations. So the printing press creates a human who doesn't think the environment affects them. So they just start making inventions and dumping them into the environment and not studying the effects of it. Then she says the self, under printing press effects, after the phonetic alphabet, the self also becomes a clear concept through the adoption of the phonetic alphabet and the spread of literacy, because this medium, the phonetic alphabet, encourages a form of introspection unknown in oral and tribal cultures and puts the individual, not the group, at the core of the community. And it starts thinking in terms of causes and why. Pre-literate cultures don't have the question why. So you start making like thinking processes that imitate the direction of the 26 letters. You know, so you're going along in a linear horizontal plane, and then that becomes words in a paragraph, thinking about how one sentence leads to the next sentence. What are the connections? So you're not illogical. That becomes hooked up as a super value in the printing press days. And then that becomes known as science. Logic and science, and backed up by visual evidence.
Right.
But we have environments now that have effects. It's very hard to use visual studies. How do you study the effect of television on a whole population? Whereas science is looking at nature and subatomic particles. You can get them and look at them under the particle accelerator or electron microscope. But what kind of instrument do you use to study the effects of a massive new media environment?
Your brain.
No, you have to. So you know what McLuhan's answer was?
What?
You just follow the news, see all the events that are happening, and make
follow
an
Drudge and Trump's Twitter.
You just look at Drudge and make an inventory of all the bizarre stories that nobody's relating, and then you'll eventually see a hidden hidden gestalt that shows the characteristics of the ground, and these events are mirroring that ground. Now, we've gone beyond that. And McLuhan is obsolete. You can't use that technique because it's gotten so complex and android mimic that Dobbs had to step in with a whole new model. And that's what we hope Lamberti writes about someday. The Dobbsian non-mosaic.
So as insanity, I move away from
Bob
the podium.
Dobbs insanity. It's what we all need to acquire. let's go over and look at the notes. What's the peanut gallery
well,
thing?
Well, look at the last sentence. Do you want to read that as I walk away from the podium?
So this is page, this is before the touch the guru. So how much of the last bit? No, no, you're cut off. I'll read it. No, I seem cut off too. Am I?
No. Perception thus relies upon the prevalence of sight.
Okay. I'm going to read. In Eastern participatory and inclusive societies, that's oral and tribal, as well as in oral societies, cohesion also derives from the immediate mimetic identification between those who observe and perceive and what is observed and perceived. This is what Alan Watts and Krishnamurti teach in Eastern philosophy that Fritjof Capra got. The observer is the observed. That's not the case in phonetic literate cultures. They don't believe the observer is the observed. Such reciprocal interplay annuls, cancels the individual self because perception is based on an inclusive and synesthetic multisensory act. Because perception is based on an inclusive and synesthetic act, mixing of the senses, not just featuring the isolated eyeball. In Western societies, typography or print tended to alter language from a means of perception and exploration to a portable commodity. So people started buying books or packages. They weren't dominated by, say, theater, where people would improvise verbal scenarios and you would be miming or involved with the meaning of Shakespeare play as it unfolds. It had beginnings of visual space because they put the proscenium arch around the Globe Theater of Shakespeare. So it started to frame theater. But there was a lot of drama, ritual, and participation in language, perception and exploration, rather than reading a package, a book, passively. All right? Perception thus relies upon the prevalence of sight over other senses and results in a mediated translation, not of what people experience, but of what they see. See, perception, not a good word there. You have to say visual perception, because all senses are perceptions. So perception, let's call it visual perception, thus relies upon the prevalence of sight over the other senses and results in a mediated, in other words, the phonetic alphabet in the book, alter what you're seeing, interlope, and results in a mediated translation, not of what people experience, but of what they see. Well, they're experiencing sight, so awkwardly stated there. Perception thus relies upon the prevalence of sight over other senses and results in a mediated translation, not of what people experience, but of what they see. Well, it is of what they experience. It hoiks up and makes the eyeball be dominant. But then there's compensating actions by the other senses. So in comes a hyperoral experience called opera to balance off the visual bias of the Gutenberg books. Then she has an italics. Perception becomes, in fact, perspective. Now, okay, there's where you're qualifying the word perception. It becomes visual space or perspective. Perception becomes, in fact, perspective and is based on a clear-cut distance between the observed landscape or situation and those who observe. It's based on a clear-cut distance or separation between what you're looking at, landscape or situation, and you, the observer. That results in points of views, angles of visions. These are all expressions which reveal how typography cracked the voices of silence and gave men an eye for an ear. They lopped off the ear and started to have a dominant eye, and then they started traveling around the world, looking at the horizon, finding out it's not a flat world, which would be a natural perception for ear cultures. But the ear rushes back with poetry and opera, and then the great revolutions in classical music, which was caused by the score, the written out score, split off from the natural singing and dancing of pre-literate people. When you can have something to look at, then you start breaking apart the threads of notes and the bars of complex visualization of sound, and then you develop instruments which follow those maps, and you get Bach and Beethoven, Mozart and Zappa. Let's see. So points of views, angles of visions are all expressions which reveal how print cracked the voices of silence. The voice of silence, a curious phrase, It could mean all the assumptions that tribal people never thought of and were there, hidden, latent in the unconscious, suddenly got voiced once you got fragmented by print and you had an eye over an ear. So that ends the lesson for today. Let's go over and see.
I rest my case.
Right. Karen rests her case, and that, just so for next time, that was page 90.
Okay.
And there's just another little short section before we go to chapter 5.